Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ, and of course online at kmjnow.com. Each week, we try to remind you that no matter where you live in this wonderful country of ours, there are heroes in your hometown, men and women willing to put their lives on the line for the freedoms that, you know, we so easily take for granted sometimes. That is true today, and it was certainly true during World War II, when more than 16 million Americans served in the armed forces, millions more at home were doing their part. More than 400,000 Americans gave their lives during the 4 years that the United States was actively engaged in the war. And today's guest came oh so close to adding to that number. Not once, not twice, but seemingly at every turn. He's been called a lot of things over the years. The Torrance Tornado, Zamp the Champ, Lucky Louie. But these days, maybe it's just one word I need to say to you. Unbroken. That's the title of the New York Times bestseller by Laura Hillenbrand. And if you caught the program last week, as judging by the time I spent this morning with a men's group at People's Church, I heard a lot of feedback about that program last week. And if you did hear that show, you've probably found that Unbroken is a pretty apt description of Louis Zamperini. Now 94 years old, but still going strong. If you missed that show, you can hear the whole thing online at kmjnow.com. Today, we're going to pick up the story where we left off last week. We're going to cover the torture that he endured at the hands of Japanese forces as a prisoner of war, the glory of his liberation, and perhaps most compelling, at least in my opinion, the personal transformation that Louis experienced and how it empowered him to go back to Japan after the war and share love and forgiveness with some people that I think we'd agree he had every earthly reason to despise. Before we move on with all of that, let's take a few minutes to go through a brief recap. And as we get started with that, I want to remind you again that at our website, kmjnow.com, we have links to Louis' website. One of the things on that website that I think is really worth your time is the long video that aired during the 1998 Winter Olympics in Nagano, Japan, that really covers Louis' story from start to finish, just like the book Unbroken does, or Louis' autobiography, The Devil at My Heels. So with that said, let's go back now and recap to Louis' teenage years. He was setting running records. He even set an American record in the mile for high schoolers. He qualified for the 1936 Olympics in the 5,000 meters, but I guess you could say self-control may not have been the 19-year-old strong suit. And he shared with us last week how, surrounded by a smorgasbord on his cruise across the Atlantic to compete in the Olympic Games, he gained 14 pounds before he even got to Germany.
Then when he got to Berlin, I thought, I'm going to work it off. But then they have this beautiful village. They had a semicircle, two-story building, and each door was a door to every nation's cuisine. And so I had to try them all.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I couldn't keep up the pace in the 5,000 meters. And so I'm way behind, 50 yards behind the leading pack. I'm in the second pack of guys. But in the last lap, I thought, oh, man. But my brother always told me, he said, he was a coach, he said, everybody's tired the third lap of the mile. But think of it this way, just open up and run your guts out, because isn't 1 minute of pain worth a lifetime of glory? So I sprinted the whole last lap, and of course it brought the grandstand up to see a runner gaining 50 yards on the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down the home stretch with the first pack, but I only got eighth place. But then it was in the papers that I ran the last lap in a blistering 56 seconds, which is unheard of. And then as a result of that, I got Goebbels, I guess it was, came over from the officers. German officers were between Hitler and the American team.
Right.
And he said, Hitler wants to see you. I said, hey, I didn't win a gold. He said, well, he wants to see you. I went over and he just said, the boy with the fast finish, a light handshake, and that was it. So I guess it was exciting to see someone gain 50 yards, even though I didn't win anything.
Well, it sounds exciting to me, and if I had been announcing that race, I think I would have been going crazy watching you sprint past them.
And by the way, Jesse Owens and Mac Robinson, they were my roommates in the village.
Mm.
They're great guys, both of them, and Jesse Owens especially, he was a prince.
So that was Mac Robinson, older brother of baseball legend Jackie Robinson. Mac was a tremendous athlete himself. He won a silver medal in those Berlin games, finishing second to Jesse Owens in the 200 meters. Owens, of course, won four gold medals, and Hitler's reaction to that was a little different than the way he congratulated Louis Zamperini. That much has been well documented. You know, when I was in college at Syracuse University, I had the great privilege of sitting down for lunch with Marty Glickman. If you don't recognize that name, Marty was a legendary sports broadcaster, really one of the reasons that I went to school at Syracuse, because he started the great line of sportscasters to come through there. And Marty Glickman really pioneered basketball play-by-play. In fact, if you listen to Fresno State's game against Hawaii tonight, you'll hear me use terms to describe the layout of the court that Marty Glickman was the first one to come up with. He pretty much invented the lexicon for basketball play-by-play. But before that, Marty was a Jewish-American sprinter on that 1936 Olympic team. And his story is pretty unique, too. He and another runner of Jewish heritage were removed from the 4x100 relay team at the last minute because of Nazi sympathizers in the American ranks. Marty Glickman died in 2001, but I bring up his name because if you check out our website, kmjnow.com, you'll find a link to a 60 Minutes piece where Marty Glickman describes something he saw Louis Zamperini do before they left Berlin. So after the show, go take a look at that. We don't have Marty Glickman here to tell us here on the radio, but here's how Louis described that on last week's program.
I was standing in front of the chancellery, and I thought, what a beautiful building with these groins and pillars. And then I noticed all the beautiful flags flying from the top of the building. Those were long satin-like flags. You could never get near them. But then I saw a smaller flag down on the front wall, and I saw the guards walking back and forth. I timed them, and I had plenty of time to get across the street, get that flag, and get away. But when I got there, the flag was higher than I had anticipated. And then the guards did reach the corner. When they turned around and saw me, they began to scream in German, and I knew they were mad. But I jumped up, clutched the flag in my hand, and ripped it from the pole. And then I did what I do best, and that's run. And then I heard a crack like a rifle shot. And the word halt was saying, well, I didn't need an interpreter for that. And so I halted, and they came up, and they spun me around rather rudely until they saw the American and Olympic flag on my coat pocket. And then they start talking to each other. And then the one officer who spoke very poor English, but I could understand him, he said, but why did you tear down the swastika, you know? And I said, well, I just wanted to take it home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had in your country.
Well, they couldn't argue with that, and Louis still has that flag 75 years later. And that brush with the Gestapo was child's play compared to the challenges that were still to come. Louis hoped to run and would have had a great chance at gold at the 1940 Olympics in Tokyo, but those games were canceled because of Japan's already engaged war with China at that time. After the attacks on Pearl Harbor, Louis, like so many millions of Americans, joined the war effort, and he ended up as a bombardier on a B-24 crew in the Pacific. We heard him describe some incredibly close calls that he and his crewmates survived. And you may have also heard him relate the not-so-encouraging nickname thrown around from time to time about the B-24. That would be the Flying Coffin. And it nearly became Louis' coffin on May 27, 1943, when his crew was asked to go out looking for a downed B-25. The only plane the 11th Bomb Group had available to them that day was a B-24 called the Green Hornet, and they were hesitant to fly because that plane had a reputation as a musher. It did not fly so well. They didn't have a lot of confidence in it, but it passed inspection, and it was the only one available, so they had to go.
And we're scanning the ocean, and suddenly the number one motor goes out. Well, that plane could hardly fly on four, so we're having a struggle, and just as they were trying to keep the plane straight and level and keep the altitude, the number two motor goes out. Well, with two motors on this plane, the Green Hornet just nosed over to the left wing down and just plowed right into the ocean and blew up. Pieces all over the place. Oxygen tank, gas tank, and what have you. And then, of course, the plane sank. But there were two life rafts that ejected from the plane automatically. And I was trapped in the waist section. My job is to hold a deflated raft in my arms in front of me. And as soon as we crashed, I ducked down low behind the tripod of the machine gun mount. And I ended up under the mount with the raft under my belly and my back up against the tripod. So I'm in there so solid, I doubt if two men could have got me out. And then the tail snapped off. When the tail snapped off, all the control wires go within an inch and a half of the tripod. And those are springing wires. They just curl up. They curled up all around me to make my situation even tougher. And I knew this was it. I knew that so I started to sink. And I felt my ears pop, so I knew I was down 20 feet. And then I kept sinking down into the darkness. And then I felt a terrible pain in my forehead. I don't know what that was, but it felt like someone hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I lost consciousness. Now, before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God, help me. And then I lost consciousness. And then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife. So I knew there was no way I could get out. And then I realized I was still in the plane and I was fighting for air, so I started to flail around with my arms. I'm in the waist section of the ship, pitch dark, and my USC ring on my index finger snagged onto the waist window. And that's what I was looking for. And then I realized what it was. I pulled myself out, inflated my life jacket, swallowing everything. I swallowed gas, oil, and blood all the way to the surface, threw it all up. Then I came up and looked. I heard, help, help. So the pilot and tail gunner were over hanging onto a gas tank, and they saw me. And they called, help, help. So the life raft was drifting away in the current, so I'm trying to catch the raft. But I'm fully clothed with shoes on, and I couldn't catch the raft. And I thought, this is it. We're dead. And then as I turned back to look at the pilot and the tail gunner, there's a 100-yard, about 100-foot cord attached to the trigger on the CO2 cartridge on the raft, and it's also embedded in the fuselage of the ship, and that's what inflates that raft. Well, as I looked over towards the other two guys, the last 3 feet of that cord was going by my face, somewhat submerged. I couldn't really see it until it got close to me, and I grabbed that and reeled the raft back in, and that saved our lives, that raft. And then I wrote to my buddies that the pilot's head had two gashes, blood was spurting, arterial blood. And so I had to, first of all, get a compress made out of my T-shirt. And I took another T-shirt and tied that down tight. And the funny thing is, I heard a gurgling sound. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, and then never heard another sound. So somebody had come to the surface, badly wounded, and just trying to say help, I guess. But it sounded gurgling. And then we couldn't find anything. So whoever it was, it just came to the surface momentarily and then sank. And so there's three of us now in the raft. And the tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look, nobody's going to die. We'll be rescued this afternoon or tomorrow. Well, the next day, it settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming, so I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming. So I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand on my knuckles. I cracked him across the face and knocked him on his butt. And he just lay there in complete contentment. He had a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again. And after that, no problem.
Well, the problem was it would be 47 days floating on that raft, drifting more than 2,000 miles to the Marshall Islands before Louis was picked up. They're going to make a major motion picture about Louis's story. And I have a feeling that when they do, the crash of the Green Hornet and Louis' survival at sea, fending off sharks, being strafed and bombed by enemy aircraft, the mental exercises that included cooking up imaginary meals, as he described for us last week, and all of those events will be some of the most compelling parts of that film. And, you know, I said he was picked up, but this was not a celebrated rescue. They were picked up by Japanese forces, and Louis insists all those mental exercises during his time afloat to keep that mind of his sharp, well, those mental exercises would come in handy when the enemy ended up interrogating him.
We were taken to the Death Island, an execution island called Kwajalein, and we were taken into a highly skilled a panel of intelligence officers for grilling, and we were able to defeat them. Now, every time I was in there and I got back to my cell, I would lay there. I had nothing but time. I had constant diarrhea. I weighed 65 pounds, and the water they gave us to drink didn't do any good. It went right through us.
Now, 65 pounds. Before this, you weighed about 165, right?
Right.
Holy moly.
Anyway, the panel, we were able to defeat them on every account because we kept thinking of what they could ask us. Now, you had all day long to do that. For two or three days, then they called you back in, so we were ready for them.
One of his interrogators would turn out to be someone he had attended the University of Southern California with, and you'll hear more about that man, James Sasaki, when we move on with Louis' story. But finishing this little catch-up portion of the show to set the stage here, Louis' day of execution had already been set, but his captors realized that maybe his notoriety as an athlete could be exploited.
Anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, that made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken, on the raft, unbroken here, because then they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast, and then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew, but it was so incoherent that the government, that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
And there were more days than he could count where it felt like that official government status would become all too accurate. Okay, for those of you who didn't hear last week's interview, you are now caught up. And if you did hear it, I hope I have refreshed your memory and you've enjoyed it the second time around as well. So now we are ready to move on. And when we come back, Louis Zamperini goes into detail about the torture he endured and from those horrors to the transformation in his life that enabled him to forgive the enemy. All new material with Louis Zamperini when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. That, of course, is Wild Blue Yonder, performed by my great friends with the Sounds of Freedom Band. You can see them in concert all over the San Joaquin Valley, including a big fundraiser concert at Warner's Theater on May 21st. The veteran featured today, Louis Zamperini, served in the U.S. Army Air Corps in World War II, so that's the reason for Wild Blue Yonder coming back here. You've heard about his crash, his survival at sea, and now we'll get more about his captivity, more than 2 years as a prisoner of war. And the central character in that experience was a Japanese sergeant named Matsuhiro Watanabe, also known as the Bird. And let's get a taste of why Watanabe would come to inhabit the nightmares of Louis Zamperini for years.
On a daily basis, I'm beaten, and so I have to keep as far away from when Watanabe, the Bird, we called him. And so I'm in a barracks with about 70 other men. So I always stayed in the back of the barracks so they come in for inspection. Two guards come in first and holler chest K until you come to attention. And then the Bird does whatever he does. So he comes in. I'm way in the back. He came in and he looked around for about 5 or 7 seconds. He kept looking around for me and he saw me. And he hollered, you come to attention last. Well, he looked around for a long time before he said that. And I didn't come to attention last, but he wanted to work me over. So he called me up. He had a big web belt about a 3/8 of an inch thick and 4 inches wide and a 1 pound steel buckle on the end, a big buckle. He took his belt off and hit me across the forehead, knocked me to the ground. Now, I don't go down easily, but I'm laying there bleeding, and then he took out a piece of toilet paper, and he handed it to me, and he said, "Oh, like, I'm sorry." And I said, "Well, he can't be that bad." So I wiped the blood. And I stood up. I took the tissue, and I pulled it away from my head to look to see how much blood was on it, and he hit me again in the same spot.
Oh.
This time I stayed down. And but I got that, you know, that was almost on a daily basis, the beatings from him. And I guess they gave word somehow that because I refused to make the broadcast on Tokyo Rose's program, that I was to be punished repeatedly. So I took a beating there, and then I thought, well, if I go to a slave labor camp, I'll get away from him. But they transferred him a week earlier. Now they have 100 camps in Tokyo proper. And they sent him to the very camp that I came to, so I had to put up with him again.
Holy moly.
And again, he threatened my life over and over again. And he said, if I draw my sword, I must use it. That's samurai law, you know. And then he had me take care of a sick goat. The goat was dying. He says, the goat dies, you die. Well, I knew the goat was going to die, and he did too. When the goat died, he took me outside and called everybody out, all the prisoners, hundreds. And I'm standing out there alone, and then he walks back and forth with his hand on his sword. The goat die, you die. And then finally he got two guys to bring over a big 4x6 cherry wood log, which is heavy, about 6-8 feet long, and he made me hold it over my head. Well, I held it for 10 minutes that I can remember, and then I went numb. And Henley Wade from England, he had a watch, and he timed it 37 minutes, and I couldn't believe I held it that long, but I wasn't conscious of holding it after the first 10 minutes.
Mm. Your story is so unbelievable, Louis. From you could have been shot to death in the plane, you could have drowned, you could have starved to death, you almost did, now you're almost beaten to death in captivity. So when you got to that moment where you were finally liberated, how wonderful a day was that for you?
Well, that was it was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left, and then the bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it.
Mm.
But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men.
Mm.
We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it. And that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, the highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us, and instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home, so we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little bit, a little more every day until they got used to it.
And isn't it incredible that after all that, these emaciated Americans were willing to share that food with their Japanese guards? I cut Louis off there. I didn't let him finish the story about the bird and that beam that he had to hold above his head for 37 minutes. Well, after 37 minutes, the bird punched him in the stomach, the beam fell on Louis's head, and knocked him unconscious. Not that you didn't think it was bad before, but now I think you have an even clearer picture of how brutally Louis was treated.
Now, your story is just so incredible, Louis. Very few people in the history of the world have endured everything that you have, and I know we're running short on time here. You talked about the liberation. You come home. Obviously, you're in no shape to be an Olympian again for 48 in London.
Right.
But eventually, you realized maybe that there was a purpose, that everything that had happened to you could be turned into good in your life, and I understand that Billy Graham had a role in that?
Yeah, eventually, Billy, when I got, I took my time coming home, by the way. I got fattened up, and I was back to a normal weight by the time I got to San Francisco. And it was really, and that's another story, the repatriation. You could do another book on that.
I believe it. Maybe you should.
Anyway, I went to hell, almost got killed on the way home. There was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but it was socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. We were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip. Stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila, and we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside. And the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah, anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, the big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married. But I had a terrible nightmare. I had these nightmares in prison about the bird. I was always strangling the guy, and I had that nightmare all the way home. I never missed a night. And before I got married, I had a nightmare every night. After I got married, I still had the nightmares. Mm. I'm always strangling the bird. And I grabbed my wife by the throat one night, and boy, I got scared. I woke up in a cold sweat, and then I started to drink heavily and became a boozer. And then she decided it was time for a divorce. But then somebody talked her into going down to hear a new young evangelist, Billy Graham. And she came home speaking of this peace and joy she had in her heart and life, and I wouldn't go with her. I got mad, but then she said something that made me happy. She said, because of my conversion, I'm not going to get a divorce. Well, that softened me up a little bit, so I did go down to hear Billy, but I walked out the first night mad. I said, I'll never go back to that place again, but the next day, after 2 hours of argument, she got me back. As I started to leave, he was, in his preaching, he said, when people come to the end of their rope, and there's nowhere else to turn, they turn to God, no matter who you are. I thought, yeah, that's what happened to me on the raft in prison camp on Kwajalein. And that made me feel like a fool. I prayed the same prayer over and over again, God, get me home alive, and I'll seek you and serve you. Here I am alive, and I didn't try to seek God. So then I went forward in the meeting and made a confession of my faith in Christ, and boy, I knew something happened. I was still on my knees, but I knew I was through getting drunk. I knew I'd forgiven all my guards, and including the bird. That was something. And I was a different person. Right there on my knees, I got up, went home, and that's, my life has been changed ever since.
And you eventually became a missionary in Japan, the same country that had tortured you. You talked about the bird and you forgave him. I guess you did, if you would go back there to Japan to try to share this new love in your life with them.
Yeah, I wanted. I went back to Japan. Sagamo prisoners, where all the prisoners were, 850 of them, and nobody was allowed in there. But I called MacArthur's headquarters, SAC, and reminded him that he asked for 10 million Bibles and 2,000 missionaries when he took over the country, but we didn't respond. And that's all. He let me into the Sagamo prison, so I was the first outsider allowed in there to speak, and 850 war criminals. And the colonel asked me to give them a chance to become Christians, so I did. And then he asked those who knew me to come forward. So about 8 guards came forward, and sure enough, there was James Sasaki, head interrogator in Japan proper, and he's the one that went to SC with me in 37, 38, 39. And so I said, well, where's the bird? And he said, well, we believe he committed harakiri. And so I assumed he was dead all these years, and then when CBS did my show out of Nagano during the Olympics, Donna Mihailovich was in Tokyo, and he called me and he said, are you sitting down? Yeah. You got a hold of your chair? I said, I got a hold of my chair. What's up? He says, we found the bird. He's alive. Oh, couldn't believe it. So anyway, they took a picture of a movie of him, and it was on 60 Minutes, and it's still being shown across the nation. The Olympic Committee sends him out to schools, and everybody can see the entire story in about 35 minutes.
And that is online, and I'll make sure that we point a link to that.
Yeah, they called it the Great Zamperini, which I didn't like, but he said, well, you know, there was the Great Mussolini, the Great Zucchini, and the Great Houdini. So I thought, well, in that case, I'll leave it.
You prefer Lucky Louie, huh?
Yeah, Lucky Louie's fine. A great. I don't think anybody's great.
Well, boy, I think a lot of our listeners would disagree with you at this point after hearing just bits and pieces of your story, and there is much more online. You did go to Nagano, which was very close to where you had been held captive, and that's kind of where all this sprung, including the book Unbroken. I understand that Laura Hillenbrand saw that piece from Nagano during the Winter Games, and that's why she was inspired to write the book Unbroken.
Right, yeah.
And, Louie, I know we're getting short on time here, but what are you doing now? Why is it so important for you to share your stories with others? What do you get out of it?
Well, I get a great satisfaction out of it. Whenever you, and people should know this, whenever you do good or give to charity, you feel good. Okay, when you feel good, that's a chemical reaction. That's white corpuscles invading your immune system. And so whenever you've done a favor for somebody and you felt good about it, something's making you feel good. That's what it is. And so on a daily basis, I'm happy continually. I'm always looking for someone to help, kids to counsel with, adults to counsel with that are getting divorced. And my youth camp program in the High Sierra has ended, but I get more youth now through schools. I speak to groups of 300 or 3,000 students at one time. Next week, I'm speaking at USC to all the athletes, 250 athletes, and I get all kinds of calls and letters showing that whatever I spoke about helped them. And that's the idea, is to spend my whole life helping others that are in need of help.
And something tells me you're not going to stop until someone tells you that you fought the good fight and you finished the race.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, I still get, I got a lot of letters here from young people writing and saying how they read the book and it changed their life, and they want to correspond. And it's pretty hard for me to correspond with all the mail I'm getting, but I take the real hard cases, sad cases, and I do correspond with them.
Well, Louie, you are amazing, and I want to thank you so much for spending so much of your time with me this afternoon. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for everything that you're doing today to inspire people, and keep on running.
Well, thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
God bless you.
Okay, hold on.
Well, he said hold on there because Louie was going to get the man that you're going to hear from next. John Neighbor, a 4-time Olympic gold medalist and accomplished broadcaster who is now spending a good chunk of his valuable time with Louie Zamperini. So when we come back, John Neighbor on his relationship with Louis, what he's most impressed by, and what those two are up to these days. Remember to go to kmjnow.com for links to Louis's book, Devil at My Heels, as well as Laura Hillenbrand's bestseller, Unbroken. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you are a University of Southern California Trojan fan or alum, you recognize that fight song. Just another little tribute to our guest today, Louis Zamperini, as well as the next man that you're going to hear from. That is Fight On, a title Louis Zamperini has clearly lived up to throughout his life. And you'll forgive me for playing USC's fight song, won't you, Bulldog fans? I'll see you at the Save Mart Center tonight, and you can let me know. More on that if I have time at the end.
I welcome in now John Neighbor, like Louis, an Olympian and, in fact, an Olympic champion. If you didn't hear about Mark Spitz in 1972, you probably would have heard more about John Neighbor in 1976 because he won four gold medals in Montreal, including dominating what was my favorite stroke growing up, the backstroke. He's been in broadcasting for many years since then. He's done just about everything you can in broadcasting. But, John, it seems to me that you have another passion here. You go around with Louis Zamperini, facilitating speaking engagements for him, doing some question and answers with him. How did that come about, and why is this such an important part of your life now?
Well, I met Louis in 1983. We're both USC Trojans. We're both Olympic athletes, and somebody thought that we'd have a lot in common, and we did. We had our common faith, and I enjoyed the man. And in 1984, I was privileged to pass my Olympic flame to him as part of the 1984 Olympic torch relay. And we had a good, common speaking relationship. But in 1998, the CBS video footage of his World War II exploits aired on television. And it was the first time I'd ever heard about that part of his life. And it's something like finding out your grandfather neglected to mention he won the Nobel Prize. I mean, I was absolutely shocked. But I realized that, the man is so humble and so gracious. And I wanted a lot of people to hear his story, if ever possible. Well, at about that time, I was president of the Olympic alumni. I received a phone call from an ocean cruise liner, the Crystal Cruise Lines. They were using one of their ships as a hotel in the Sydney Harbor during the 2000 Sydney Olympics. And they wanted some Olympic athletes to lecture on the cruise that took the boat into the harbor from Hawaii. And so I suggested Louis. He would be perfect for their passengers. Well, it turns out he got a higher score from the passengers than any other lecturer had ever received on any cruise ship in history. Louis connects with the audience. And so it gratified me so much that I said, he's not only has a good story, but he tells it well. So let's see how I can help him meet as many people as possible. I've been doing motivational speaking for years, and a lot of speaking requests would arrive, and if due to schedule or budget, I wasn't able to handle them, Louis was quick to jump in, and he has absolutely wowed every audience he's addressed ever since. He's actually been a motivational speaker for over half a century, and so he's pretty darn good at it. Well, when we knew that Laura Hillenbrand's book, Unbroken, was about to be released, we knew that the invitations for his time would increase. Louis doesn't use a computer, and so his family asked if I would be willing to help schedule some of his interviews and his appointments, and that led to a relationship with the Speakers Bureau, and now Louis is being booked all over the country, and I'm happy to carry his baggage. I consider myself John the Baptist to Louis Zamperini.
Well, and that's an apt description. And, I mean, you've been everywhere in sports, John. You're a four-time Olympic gold medalist in one Olympiad in 76. You've announced Olympics. You've announced just about anything in sports. How does any of that compare to the experience you have watching Louis connect with his audience?
Well, I have to be honest and say that though I was the best backstroker in the world, the ability to swim quickly while on your back is of limited value in society at large. And yet, what I see Louis do and the way he affects his audience, he's changing lives. I've personally met people who said that Louis prevented them from getting a divorce when they were going through a difficult patch. Or that I'm reading emails that come into the louiszamperini.com website every day. and people are in tears, or people are overcoming alcohol, or people are recommitting their life to their faith, or people are reconnecting with their families because of the impact of reading the story that Louis absolutely endured. Certainly, Laura Hillenbrand tells it very well. Louis tells it very well in his own autobiography, Devil at My Heels. And it's just a pleasure to be a witness to this kind of life-changing force that is called Louis Zamperini.
Boy, I certainly couldn't put it any better than that. In closing, John, is there any one thing about Louis that you think makes him unique, that makes him as amazing as he clearly is at 94, and people just heard him, and they hear this show every week, and they hear men much younger who aren't as quick and sharp and have as clear a memory as Louis does. What about him makes him who he is?
Well, I don't know enough World War II veterans to say he's the only one like this. In fact, I guess many World War II veterans are very alert and very articulate. But Louis is the real deal. He's totally authentic. I've been listening to his stories for 20 years, and he's never contradicted himself. He knows what he's all about, and he lives the life he talks about. When he says all things work together for good, that is his life philosophy. He's able to roll with the punches. You know, he's outlasted the bird. He's outlasted the guards that were eating while they were starving him. He's outlasted the guys in the life raft. He's outlasted the guys who didn't crash in World War II, because I think his faith is a big part of that, and the way his faith affects his lifestyle is a big part of that. I'm just honored to be able to be witness to this.
Well, and it's been such an honor having you guys on today. If someone was listening today and they would like to get you and Louis to come up and speak to an audience, how do they go about doing that?
You know, the easiest thing to do is to visit louiszamperini.com. That's louiszamperini.com. On there, you can order copies of Unbroken or Devil at My Heels, personally autographed by Louis himself. You can also fill out a form that requests information about his personal appearances. And we've got speakers bureaus on hand ready to make follow-up phone calls to see if this can be worked out. And I should also note that the rights to the book Unbroken have already been purchased for a possible movie. And in my estimation, you're going to see the Louis Zamperini story on the big screen within a couple of years. So what I would say is appreciate Louis now before the rush. It's going to get real wild and woolly in a couple of years.
Well, I can't wait to see it, and I know Louis will still be as vibrant then as he is now. John, thank you so much for making this happen today, and Godspeed in all your efforts.
Thank you very much, and I've been listening to your interviews, and you are the most well-prepared questioner we've had talk to Louis in a long time.
Well, good deal. You guys put some good information out there for me to read, and certainly Laura's book is outstanding as well. John, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, just one more case where the pleasure is absolutely all mine. It is every week on this show, isn't it? I've gotten to know so many wonderful families, learned so much from the hundreds of veterans that I've encountered. About a veteran a week over the last 5 years. Time flies, but it's incredible to think of all the great people I've met. This past week, I also got to visit again with the Coulthard family in Lewiston, Idaho. One of the neat things about all the travel that I get to do announcing Bulldog Sports is that it reminds me time and time again that there really are heroes in every one of our hometowns in America, no matter east or west, north or south, no matter how big or how small. And before that Bulldog game in Moscow Thursday night, I caught up with Laverne Coulthard, who told of his Marine Corps experiences a time ago on this program. So, you know, if you ever think of a veteran that you think I ought to catch up with, he doesn't have to be here in Fresno or the San Joaquin Valley. I'm traveling quite a bit, so send me an email, paul@kmjnow.com. And remember to go to our website for all the items I've mentioned with regard to our guest these last 2 weeks, Louis Zamperini. You shouldn't have any trouble finding it. It's the top story on the left-hand side of the page at kmjnow.com. Just look for the words, Still Unbroken. It says it all about Louis Zamperini, doesn't it? And hopefully you'll find everything you need there. I just have a few moments left with you, and I don't know if I've ever done this on Hometown Heroes before, but I would really like to invite you to the Save Mart Center tonight. If you're in the greater Fresno area, it's your last chance to see the Fresno State basketball teams at home this year. The women, who've had a terrific year under Coach Adrian Wiggins, will play at 6 o'clock, the senior night, for an outstanding group of seniors, including the all-time leading scorer, Jaleesa Ross. And then at 8 o'clock, or a little thereafter, the men will tip off. And also showing up tonight will be some Fresno State football greats. David Carr, Ryan Matthews, Bernard Berrien, they're all expected to attend. They'll be signing autographs starting at 6:30. Our pregame coverage for the men's game starts starts at 7 with Bulldogs Live here on KMJ. But watching the Dogs in Idaho Thursday, I thought they played with a different energy, a different intensity, a whole new team, really. And we'll see if they take a big step forward tonight against a Hawaii squad that has won 5 in a row coming into this one. So we'll tell you all about that tonight at 7 here on KMJ. But I really don't think you'll be disappointed if you come. And I do hope to see you there at the Save Mart Center tonight. I also hope that you'll be back with us here on the radio next Saturday afternoon when we move on from this incredible story of Louis Zamperini to a hometown hero right here in the San Joaquin Valley with a pretty unique story of his own to share. We're out of time today, but thanks so much for listening, as always, to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.